does indeed seem to be a very hospitable environment. So thank you very much. The penalty for my coming here is that some of you have to listen to me for the best part of an hour. I do not have experience in quantum mechanics. I mean, I've got a physics degree, so I know the language and all this stuff. I've been doing classical inference. As Chris told you, that's how I actually make my living. I gave up on the academic life when it got a little bureaucratic. I'm sure you understand that sort of thing. And sell scientific programs, which are Bayesian. That's where we are. And what I want to talk about today is clarification, polishing, if you like, of the well-understood language of probability theory. And that'll take us into information and entropy and allied subjects with extension to questions, which is my colleague Kevin Knuth's speciality, aiming for robotics, automated acquisition of knowledge and stuff. Kevin can't be here, he's in hospital, unfortunately, which is very sad because some of the things I want to say will annoy him a bit, or would annoy him. He's not here, so I'm free to say them. So, the long-term aim as an intellectual I'd like to aim for is understanding quantum mechanics to the same depth that I believe we understand probability theory. There are schools of thought about this, there are dinosaurs, but I'm a Bayesian and I find that Bayesian thinking is not just correct, it's inevitable. There's no other way of thinking reasonably. And I haven't yet managed to get to the same level of understanding of quantum mechanics where this language is inevitable. It seems to me, you know, God could have done something else. In probability theory, he can't. He has to do it this way. Anyway, inference is the main subject and questions at the end. By all means, butt in and ask me questions during the talk. There's only a few of you here. If it gets out of hand, I'm quite capable of cutting it down and getting on. So stop me when you want, when I say something that's not clear. As I've been rabbiting on, you've probably already been reading that I'm interested in the classical world. There are various states of the world. Now, traditionally, these states have often been thought of as, you know, exclusive states, different states, which don't have any intersection. But actually, you know, it's perfectly possible to have worlds in which the states do imply each other. Most phenomena, I would suggest, are of this more general class and not of the traditional, simplistic, all states are different class. So, if I want a foundation for inference, I want to have this sort of environment. That sort of environment is a set. Yeah, it's got order in it, but doesn't have complete order. It's not like this, which would be a complete order implication going up the board. So if I have this, I must have this. I don't have complete order, I've got what's called partial order. And that's a poset. So I want to found inference upon the structure of posets. Now my thesis is going to be that the structure of inference about a poset, that structure by itself defines us the calculus, forces us to Bayesian thinking. It's rather surprising. Yes.
Oh, yes. So here you were using imply and here you were using needs, and that confused.
Okay, let's do it this way. If I see a boy, girl, these are two states, exclusive states of things I might be seeing, then there are implications of that there are parents involved.
because you can't have a boy or girl without a parent.
Now, in a sort of physical sense, the parent comes before the child, but in the implication sense, if I see a child, then I know I've got a parent. Okay. So, implies goes up the board, and that's going to be my convention. Yep.
What do you mean by state? You don't mean preposition, right?
No, I don't. Well, what do I mean by state? Do I mean proposition? I'm going to use the word assertion later on. I'm not yet talking about my states of mind about these things. I'm talking about the states of the world. Well, yeah, okay, I have a proposition, it's a board. Let me move on. Post-its have got mathematics. Now, there's a tension in what we do these days between mathematical formalism and what we actually do in practical computation. The mathematics tends to be very abstract, clean, has its own aesthetic, and the computation has a different aesthetic. And you can see this in the terminology. I'm disappearing off the top of the screen there. A poset is defined through three properties. I'm talking about a less than or equal relationship. So boy is less than or equal to boy. And it's also less than parent.
You said boy is less than or equal to girl. Is that?
I thought, yeah.
Sorry, I kind of tried to talk and write at the same time. Thank you very much. Boy equals girl is a different matter entirely. Now, from my computational point of view, and this is how I think, it's how I make my living, it's the modern world, as it were, 20th, 21st century rather than 19th, to be a little difficult about these things. Computer people think in terms of bits, and the structure of a poset can be defined by which state is beneath any other state. Is it a one? Is there a one connection between these two things, or is there not? An indicator function. And just for example, here is five possible states of a system. Nobody at all, boy, girl, parent, grandparent would be one possibility. And we're going to set up a computational coding for this. I'm not doing sort of formal mathematics about states A, B, C. I want to think about this in terms of computations, bits. Now, the simplest, not the shortest, but the simplest way of putting up a coding poset is to assign a bit for every state. This is a five-state system, and we'd have five bits for it. And the first bit is the bottom element, second bit would be for A, next bit for B, then both, then those are the five states. And I just fill in the indicator function for the other bits. It's called a poset coding. It's not the shortest. I sometimes say that it's like talking Welsh. You know, the English name for somewhere would be like, you know, York or London or something nice and short. The Welsh name would be Llanfair Ogrygoch Llantysil. It would be something like, you know, the house by the hill by the little rowan tree up by the graveyard. That's the thing. It's a descriptive name. Well, these poset codes are Welsh names for the elements. They're identifiers, but they also have all the structure embedded in there. So it's very nice. And you can make it triangular and all that stuff. Now, having got those indicator functions, you can go back and use them, of course. There's no point of having a notation that you can't use. And you can use them to find out which elements are below which.
just see if there is a rowan tree in the Welsh name. And if so, rowan is leaf, the name of the place we're in, we're at. So this is how I code my classical world. There's a matrix which is full of ones, the top of the diagonal, which is called chain, fully ordered set of states. Or there's the, at the other extreme, the traditional anti-chain, or exclusive states, where there's no partial order, at least if there is, we're not using it. Okay. That, however, is a poset, but it's boring, because it hasn't got enough structure to give us anything interesting. Here we go for the real stuff, which I want to know, learn about, which is inference. My knowledge, or belief, or prejudice, call it what you will, is uncertain. I've always got imperfect information. Still in the classical world, of course, it carries on even more so in quantum mechanics, but even in the classical world, I can be uncertain of what I'm looking for. And this goes back to your proposition thing. Not sure which of these would be propositions, not being a philosopher, but my state of mind about the family could be that I simply don't know. I see a child, but I don't know whether it's a boy or a girl. So what I classify this, I construct states of mind by looking at the states of the world and saying, well, it could be this or that or the other. Or that or the other. Whole family of ors of the various possibilities. And closure under or is the fundamental operation how we list possible states of mind, which we'll need in order to do inference, to learn about the external world. This closure under or is what's called all the theoretic exponentiation in mathematics. And I'm just going to call it expansion. The shorthand is exp, so it's short for expansion. The result of closure is a distributive join semilattice. Now this result of closure under all, this lists all my states of mind. This is a basic thing we need for inference. It's what we're doing, it's the framework. And I refuse to take the standard, exact, precise terminology of distributive joint semilattice and use that term 37 times in the paper talking about inference. So, to me, the result of closure, the set of states of mind, is the canvas on which I paint my pictures of the world. So shorthand canvas. Terminology matters. Just as an aside, we physicists do inference and we find the probability of a model and describe it, calculate it, as a number called the evidence. Statisticians will call it the prior predictive, or the marginal likelihood, or half a dozen variants on these names. And each of these names is sort of double barrel, so it makes it look as if the concept is unimportant, and it isn't, it's fundamental. And I think this is terrible, so it diverts attention from the importance of this number. So we give it a name, and it's catching on, and I recommend it. But generally, good terminology is important for understanding the subject. Don't make things too technical.
Can I understand your canvas? Just for a second. So an assertion is something of the form, this world is in this state or that state or some other state.
This state or that state or some other state. Yes?
Okay, and then the set of all assertions?
Is the or of that. My state of mind could be, I know it's this state. It could be, I know it's this state. I could be, I know it's this. It could be, I know it's this or this. That's not the same as this one.
knowing boy or girl is not the same as knowing parent. But knowing boy or parent is the same as knowing parent, because if I know boy, then I know parent. So it's just, I'm doing an entirely natural thing. It's just you're probably used to seeing, well, Curtis is right this side for you, isn't it? You're more used to seeing states laid out like this, A, B, C, with A or B, A or C, B or C, A or B or C. In that sort of pattern, a Boolean pattern. That's what you're used to. All I'm doing is putting partial order on that to make it a more general sort of pattern. So I'm embedding partial order in the structure of the world. And that has implications for the number of hypotheses, number of assertions I can make. No longer a Boolean structure.
Say the state is boy, that's not a complete description because you also can, you know that it must be true that parent is also true.
Yes.
So just saying boy is not, so these are not sort of the finest possible states of the world.
And oh, no, they're not exclusive.
It's not a complete description. They're not exclusive to each other either.
No, they're not.
So when you call, okay, so the word state has it, carries that implication.
I shouldn't have come to talk, I shouldn't have used the word state for in the physics audience, should I?
So I think, yeah.
Well,
so this proposition is closer to what?
Okay, that, proposition. That, yeah. I'll accept any terminology. Well, reasonably good terminology.
Your state of mind doesn't. Okay, so your state of mind is just a statement that certain of these propositions or these, whatever you want to call them.
Yes, are acceptable
to
me.
Are true, and you believe in.
Well, yeah, and exclude the others.
And you exclude the others?
Provisionally.
No, but if you say there's boy, then you shouldn't be excluding parent. That's what I'm confused about.
Yeah, boy would include. Boy, if I see boy, then I know there's a parent there as well. Or what?
Yeah, so what is it? So your description of the world, your provisional description is just a set of those states or propositions that you regard as true.
Could be true.
Is
yes.
That could be true.
Well, I have a world. I don't know what's in there.
But I mean, joining with or is not the same thing as joining with and. That's what I don't. I mean,
no, it's
if
not.
You say there's a boy and there's a parent, that's different from saying there's a boy or there's a parent. So,
yes.
So which kind of description is, corresponds to your state of mind?
My state of mind?
Or whatever it is, my conclusion up to.
The very simplest chain. Okay, the very simplest non. That would be a two-state world in your conventional or say traditional thinking. Two exclusive states.
Yeah.
That is a child or a person that could be male or female. So. When I look at the world, I find that quite often, if I'm looking in biology or astronomy or anything I want, then some properties imply other properties. I can't see a galaxy without stars. But I can't see stars in the outside world without galaxies. Right. Well,
is your state of mind? Does it correspond to coloring a certain number of those nodes in the poster?
My state of mind about this is that initially I have this set of possibilities for this chain of stuff, my state of mind would be this one or this one. I don't know yet. Well, yes,
those would be my two possible states of mind. I'm trying to learn by getting data. If I get data that I've got a pair of.
So a possible state of mind is an upward set in the flow surface, is that right?
Yes.
Can we define those two things, equate those two?
I'm trying to get across to, well, I have got across to closure under all as what defines my states of mind. You would be perfectly happy if I wrote anti-chains all the time. You talked about my states of mind being alternatives sitting on there.
So your state of mind is it's either this upward set or this upward set or this some list.
My state of mind could be A or B, which is that. That's one possible state of mind. Another possible state of mind would be B or C, which would include all those. My total ignorant state of mind right at the beginning would be the whole lot. And it's the purpose of data to bring me in and reduce the uncertainty that I have and come down and try to home in on one of the fundamental states.
So would it be fair to say that a state of mind would be a set of upward sets in the process?
A state of mind is an element in the closure under all of the process. It is not the process itself. The states of mind occupy the closure under all of those states. Because I don't know which state I'm in, which state system is in.
Yeah, but this poset is derived from some other more fundamental poset, right? Like who drew over, you know, this boy, girl, parents.
Yeah. Well, that's how the world is.
That's the poset.
That's how I'm almost the world.
Yeah, but
that's how I am.
I'm just trying to get a definition, that's all. Can you just give a simple definition?
I am modeling the world with a poset.
Good. I certainly approve of that. But
good. I am modeling my state of mind.
It's actually a union of upsets in the state of upset.
A union of upsets? That would be an upset itself. I think it's a disjunct.
I am going to proceed. Thank you.
Expansion can be reversed. Spend too much time, not going to talk about that. What is a little surprising to me is that OR is all we need for doing inference. We don't need AND. In fact, we get most of AND from mathematics. We don't need it all the time. And in fact, technically, we never have it at all. We don't have closure under AND because although mathematicians would put an absurd state at the bottom of their trees of inference, I don't. There is no absurd state with zero measure as far as I'm concerned. It's not there. I have a model of the world with what I'm going to call states. I don't know which state I'm in. So the closure under all gives me states of the world. But I don't close under AND. And that's not there. I don't have negation either. Negation isn't any part of this. Negation is ones going to zeros in all this. And most of these structures have codes that don't have zeros in them. This one certainly doesn't. That's 100, 1100, 1110, and so on. And interchanging noughts to ones gives you states that aren't in the system. So negation just isn't there at all. Now, the weird thing is that this structure of a canvas basically constructed as or. Any combination of ors is in the canvas. The structure of that by itself gives us the calculus of probability theory. There's no escape from this. The proof goes back to 1946 with Richard Cox, who sorted this matter out for the first time. He actually used not as well, but we've polished that out of the derivation by now. First thing I want to look for is evaluation. I have a structure of possibilities. What values can I put on a canvas, the closure of a poset? On a poset, I can put pretty much any values I want, and there's not enough structure to get a contradiction. But with ORs, it's different. We pretty much have and, not always. It's only if, well, that's a technicality. The fundamental point is this associativity. A or B or C is the same thing as A or B or C, and normally we just omit the brackets. That's a straightforward logical relationship. So, if I want some function of A, which somehow combines with evaluation on B to produce evaluation on A or B, then the valuation on A or B or C, constructed that way, had better be the valuation of A or B or C, constructed that way, because it's the same thing. And that's the associativity equation, which rather magically has a solution going back to, I think, Gabel in 1806 or something, so a long history. It says that there is some function of value which is additive. This is an extraordinarily powerful statement. The point is, original valuations were pretty much arbitrary. They could be in dollars, or they could be in square root of cents, or they could be in logarithm of cowrie shells, whatever. But whatever the scale is, we can pull it back to make it something that's additive, or in the case of money, subtractive. So this is any valuation which is works on a canvas has to be additive. And very quickly you get from the specific statement to the general. Time's too short to go into the details, but the take-home message from this is that simply by looking at the mathematical structure of what we've got, we can derive a calculus for it. And it's this ordinary sum rule that we all know and love, and it just says that if we take the poset code for elements, we get a value just by assigning values to each bit. Alpha 1 on the first bit, alpha 3 on the third bit, alpha 4 on the fourth bit. That would be the appropriate value on 10110. And all those obviously add up perfectly correctly, because if you OR elements, you've got 10110, and you've got 10001, and you OR them, you get 10111, and the values just add up, because you've got this bit, this bit, this bit, and this bit, and it's all trivial. In fact, it's embarrassing to talk such triviality. Never mind, I'm here, I'm doing it. If I want ordering as well as having the ors and ands working right, then all these little alphas had better be positive, or at least non-negative. And there, we now have a measure. Positive valuations adding up. This is why measure theory is built up as it is. You look at measure theory in a pure math book, or go to a math course, and you find straight at the beginning, you know, M of something equals, you know, sigma, and it's got an infinity on it, and it's got various bits of squiggles and probably some unions and whatnot. But this is why we use plus. There's no alternative. The reason why we do this. And I speak with a little bit of emotion on this, because I actually did a measure theory course once, and I went along for math lectures, and I looked at equation one, and I said, what? Surely mathematicians got more interesting combinations than plus? What's the matter with sine? And, you know, gosh, you know, why can't these guys be interesting? Well, this is the reason why. Lots of applications have this structure of a lattice or distributive lattice or canvas, whatever you want to call it. And for those applications, you're stuck with measure theory. There's no alternative. We got into evaluations and measures by grading, asking, could we check or finding out whether we could change the scale from square root cowrie shells to dollars? And yes, we could. Is there anything we can do other, you know, do we still have freedom? Yes, we do. We can turn dollars into francs, well, not that, euros these days, and pounds and stuff. We can multiply by constants. But that's all. But that suggests quite strongly that we can look at a measure on some canvas as a normalization times a shape, mass times a shape. And that's the foundation of probability theory. So measures come from closure under or. We're now going to move on to probability. Probabilities are bivaluations. They are context-dependent measures. I think I'm here, or could be, anything under there would work. What's the probability of this state given this one? So probabilities are, you have a context within which you think your answer lies. You look at the possible answers, and you find out which ones are plausible and which ones are implausible. There may be structure, there may be partial order in that, that's fine. I still want to navigate through the probabilities which add up to one in everything I've thought of. Of course, the truth may be somewhere else. Too bad, I can't get at it because I haven't thought of it. That's the trouble with building theories. The lovely quote from Harold Jeffries, who pointed out 70 years ago that there was never a time in the history of gravitation when Newton's law of gravity would not have been excluded from a 99% significance test. Because, of course, there are always huge data sets. There are always loads of stray little discrepancies which add up all over the place. And so, you know, you don't say that Newton's theory of gravity is wrong because of these discrepancies until you've got something better to put in its place. It's still the best you can do. The point is that you've explained a lot, not that you've explained everything. Anyway, I mustn't get too rhetorical about these things. Please?
Back to the overhead where you first introduced the closure under or. You had a tree, you know, the boy girl parent tree, and then you introduced a new vertex in there corresponding to boy or girl.
I did.
Right. So now, if I want that new structure, the code I give for the open circle, the boy or girl, is that the same code as I give for the parents?
No. I'll do this one.
Yeah.
It's there. There's a three-state world. The codes are boy, first bit, girl, second bit. Parent includes both boy and girl. But if I close under or, I also get the intermediate state 110 for boy or girl, I don't know which. So there are states in my mind which are ambiguous about states in the world. Every state of the world is a valid state of mind, but I also have more uncertain states in here than I did out there.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I should have gone through that in greater detail before. Distracted. You said there were two points.
I think that resolves both of them.
Good. Again, associativity is the key to the next step. States can be below, above and below each other. If x is below y, is below z, is below t, then it doesn't matter where we put brackets around these things, we should always get the same answers. Or, sorry, ordering is associative, just like or was. Or was also symmetrical, but associativity is all I'm wanting here. Associativity of ordering gives me another associativity equation, which has to be obeyed by a by valuation. And if I want that to be consistent with the mono evaluation meaning of this, because it's probability of state given something else, then this solution has to be consistent with W, whatever the weighting is, being a measure on X, the thing I'm trying to find the probability of in the context. So that second associativity relation by itself forces the calculus to be, forces us to the product rule. The sum rule of measure theory has come from associativity of all. The product rule of probability theory comes from associativity of ordering, and no other assumption is needed. I'm not saying anything deep here, I'm just polishing foundations. But if I want to move on to more difficult problems like foundations of quantum mechanics, I want to be able to walk before I start running. I want to be able to get my easy problems solved very in the cleanest way I can. And those two associativities give us what we want. I got the product rule. I shouldn't have put up so much detail on these things, but I have, never mind. It's even easier than that, because it is traditional to describe probability theory in terms of sums and sum and product rule and range between 0 and 1. You don't have to do that. There was an equivalent to simply saying probability is a ratio of measures. Just like the old misguided frequentists did, number of successes to number of trials. The same old definition, ratios, ratio of measures. All we've done here is come at it from a more abstract point of view. We're not talking about real successes and real trials, we're not talking about integers. We're just talking about measures which are mentally assigned in our heads. So that's probability theory. There's nothing else to it. We are forced to those rules, and if we don't use them, we'll get into trouble with the symmetries, because we'll be able to find problems which have got obvious symmetries to do with the structure of all, and we'll get inconsistent answers. Now, yep, that's fine. Physicists love variational potentials. Hamiltonians, Lagrangians, all this wonderful stuff. Statisticians haze out of this and go to sleep. This is a theoretical physicist, as you two know, about variational principles. So here's variational potential. I'd like to have some variational potential in inference. What could it be? Well, is there some sort of variational potential that has the symmetries I want? Yes. I've got measures for an arbitrary boy or girl parent system to draw on there. three-state system, well, three-world system, that's my states of mind, has three weights, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3. And we've already seen that measures get decomposed rather nicely into mass, total amount, unit of currency, whatever, and shape. It seems to me that if I have data on total mass, that shouldn't tell you the shape of the distribution. If I have data on the total amount of money in the country, that doesn't tell me how it's distributed. It just tells me whether the unit is dollars or Turkish lira. Similarly, data on the shape, what the distribution is, shouldn't tell us the mass. And this is perfectly reasonable in any application I've been able to think of where measure theory applies. And basically, this says that the variation on my potential should be a function of the mass and another function of the shape. The notation is a bit shorthand there because of mixing scales and vectors. I could write it more clearly, but it takes longer. But the idea is that in the usual Lagrange way, constraint on mass and constraint on shape are both necessary to give me my full variational problem. This drops me straight to the standard x log x form of potential that we all know to do with information and entropy, which is where I'm going in the next slide. If I want that sort of symmetry on a variational potential, then I am forced with this. So just as a measure on 1 and 1, 1, 0 would be alpha 1 plus alpha 3 plus alpha 4, the variational potential on this has to be the sum over 1, 3, and 4, A plus B alpha plus C alpha log alpha. To escape from this, there's no alternatives. I was at a conference in Copenhagen last September where halfway through, one of the organizers sort of ran a public session when we were asked to list our entropies, types of entropy. And it went on, and it went on, and it went on for half an hour. And we're still, people were having different forms for the entropy. Well, I'm sorry, guys. That's what we're talking about if we want a variational potential. Variational potential, of course, is something abstract. Can be used in various ways. I can use it to seek a distance of one distribution from another, prior to posterior, or just abstractly one distribution to another, or even one measure to another, although I'm thinking probabilities here where they all add up to one. And the form you get for that, which is zero at the beginning place and moves out positively to the outer place, is the ordinary Kullback-Leibler formula. P log P and Q, theta log P throw the alpha. If you want an uncertainty itself, how much uncertainty is there in a partition? Then any weight of zero shouldn't give you anything because you know that cell isn't there. You're perfectly certain it isn't there. Any cell of alpha equals one is definitely there. There's no uncertainty anywhere else because everywhere else has vanished because it adds up to one. So this is the Shannon formula. So we'll drop down. These formulae are usually derived with more assumptions. We don't need more assumptions. It's very, very simple, very, very easy. So, summary so far. Measure has come from associativity of or. Probability comes with the additional associativity of ordering. Information and entropy are the unique variational potential associated with this structure. And that's it.
Inference is only one application of this. Inference is my way in, because that's my personal history. But actually, this is just pure math. This is taking in POSET, closing thunder, an operation which mathematicians would call join, and I've called R, or, and finding that this unique calculus is the result. And then claiming that the standard rules are inevitable. I mentioned Kevin, my colleague, Kevin Knuth, who can't be with us today, because he's in hospital in Albany, unfortunately. What I want to talk about next is questions, which relates to his work, but this is a natural place to break and see if there are any more questions, or indeed if anyone just wants to leave because they've had enough of me. But are there any questions people are wanting to ask now before I give the last 7 or 8 minutes? No?
Just one. So when you say the closure under OR, that's like what we normally, what one normally does. You just take all possible ORs and you fill up your set, right?
Yeah. Mathematicians call it closure.
Right.
It is closed.
Yeah.
No, there are no other combinations you can have.
Yeah.
And they'll have big V signs and stuff. Okay.
Strikes me that there's a difference between the kinds of implications you get because of disjunction and the kinds of implications you started with in your original set of states.
Yes.
One is necessary by logic. Mm-hmm. The other strikes me as something that's contingent on a particular theory or some background set of assumptions.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind that.
So does that mean that the two ingredients to the probability calculus have a different status?
I don't think so for this reason. Although I have talked about general posets as the foundation I want to use. The traditional foundation is the ordinary Boolean one of independent, exclusive states with no overlap, no part of all, which there's that full Boolean structure arising. Three is a bit small, I don't know, 4 or 5, but it's what I can do in this system is go back to an arbitrary process. Well, here there's no ambiguity, there's only the one operation. I can say, oh, well, this could not happen. Because I know there's something in the structure of the model, an exclusion principle, something that prohibits that. So I can erode the Boolean structure with n arbitrary things. No, I wouldn't want to erode that one, would I?
Sorry, maybe I'm not following.
Erode that one.
Ah.
And turn it into a poset, and that thing wouldn't happen either. So if this element could not exist on its own but needed this one, I would have a different structure of the world, and I would have a reduced different structure of my inferences about it. Now I could get that by data, or I could get it by theory. I think it makes that much difference.
I don't think I'm quite following it. If the bottom ones are labeled A, B, and C,
yeah,
and these are states of the world, and you're drawing here a poset induced by disjunction, right? So we have A or B at B or A or C, B or C on the next level. And now you're saying, imagine that C is not the case, but B or C is still a state of the world? That's what I'm not... Oh.
That's the original system. Now.
But why is it B bar rather than C?
Because I was going to try to think up one thinking things as particles and antiparticles that have an exclusion principle. And those exclusion principles were going to let me. Too clever. Not clever enough. Something tells me, either data or theory, that I can't have C on its own. C has to be in conjunction with B.
And that these aren't states of the world. B or C is an epistemic claim. It's what you know about the world. How could you say that B or C might be the case while C cannot be the case? It just seems to me that the second line doesn't have the status of things that can be the case.
Well, it does by the time I've scrubbed out C. I know that C can't exist without B. Okay.
But these aren't claims about the simultaneous existence of B and C.
No, that's...
That's not what B or C represents. And that would be an and, if anything. And if you want to say that, you know, C can't be the case without B also being the case, then you're claiming that I can only state the truth of B and C, not just the truth of C. And that's B or C written down there.
It is B or C I've written down there. And I think I can't see my way through that question at the moment. And I'm not going to argue against it because your point may be correct, but these two things may have differences. And I will go away, think very carefully about ands in the construction of the states that I'm thinking about. This is how we do inference, but how I present it is certainly a matter that I must refine. If you forgive me, I will continue with a few minutes on questions. I've talked, perhaps convincingly to some of you, unconvincingly to others, anyway I've talked, about expanding a poset to states of mind as a canvas of things that I might believe. The canvas is itself a poset, and different people can be in different states of mind, and I can look at you different people and wonder which is which, and you know, not know. So just as I can expand states of the world, and I have to be careful whether I'm talking and or in those states of the world, just as I can expand those in my mind, the canvas of assertions, I can at least formally expand those assertions to questions. And a three-element world, which becomes a Boolean set of assertions, there'd be seven different opinions about this world, they do expand to this free distributive lattice of questions. And I've labeled some of them here. Maybe this could be helpful for automatic intelligence. Kevin wants to build robots to send to Mars. This is if we have a lattice of that sort of structure,
We've built it by taking 7 opinions, which I've labeled 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, 2, 3. I can apply the sum rule on those questions to get valuations on a set of questions. And in this way, we might be able to drive robots to learn things automatically for us. And the sum rule would apply, say 1 plus 2 plus 3, 2 plus 3, and the combinations go up according to the rules. As for what numbers we put onto the assertions in the first place, well, there are really only 2 candidates. There's probability or there's entropy. If we put probability on in the first case, you don't get anything useful. You're still to use this Canadian device as a pointer. Then do it. All these are the same number, 1. These 2 are just 1 plus 2, both of them, 1 plus 3. Don't get anything fresh, just get the 7 numbers I put in. The interesting assignment is that I put entropy values on there, or through information, what happens then to the questions? And the idea is that question values then are sort of sums and differences of informations, and these are called higher order informations, which sounds very grand. And one can look at ratios of these things to get the relevance of one question to another, which is something we sort of want to do. I think this question would be, I want to now find out whether there's life on Mars. Is it relevant to look for methane? So that's the aim. There is something of a problem in size, because you may have noticed that there were more questions than assertions. It was quite a big structure. And the number grows very, very fast. If I have 8 states of the world, I get this many possible questions. They're called the Dedekind numbers. They grow very, very fast. They're in class ALF2. They are 2 to the 2 to the n. Double the number of decimal places every time. So it adds a certain air of impracticality to all this. And when you put the numbers in, you get them the wrong way around, you even get some minus signs. And they get enormous very, very quickly. So I have my personal doubts about this. But nevertheless, it's a fascinating intellectual extension of the ordinary world of inference. I found it very seductive, and I don't think that I'm giving the last word on this. I think there's going to be quite a bit of backwards and forwards interactions. Kevin unfortunately can't be here to answer that. There are questions I have for him. So whether or not that has a future, I don't know. But that's the end of what I want to say, and thank you for your forbearance and indeed for your advice, which is always helpful to our common audience. So what we've been doing with Kevin anyway is polish the foundations of probability theory, and we have found on the way that we've been discovering why measure theory is used. We've also found information and entropy coming up very naturally, without any odd little assumptions. And it's firmly and simply based on closure, a logical operation, or I'm hoping that in time we can find out that quantum mechanics has also this degree of inevitability. This is an intellectual dream. I'm not there, and I haven't talked about that. I don't know enough about it yet. Thank you very much, everybody.
There's some questions now.
It's hard to ask a question because there are many points at which I did not really understand, unfortunately, what you were saying. But one thing that you, in the part, you reminded me a little of Margaret Thatcher. There is no alternative.
It's a quote from Margaret Thatcher, yes.
Yes. No. I'm, yeah, unfortunately aware of that. that makes me distrust. But another thing that just from what you yourself said makes me distrust a little bit is you want to apply this to quantum mechanics. So can you identify, on the one hand you argue that this is the only structure we could have.
Oh, on classical alone.
Yeah, but what, where have we, so the question is where have we used classicality? What would you, which of your assumptions would be weakened or changed if you were trying to apply this to quantum mechanics?
The hidden assumption I didn't tell you, which is that everything's got real values. With quantum mechanics, I would want complex numbers assigned to the states at a minimum. Yeah, I've got real values everywhere.
So these numbers are not degrees of belief, for example. Or are you saying
degrees of belief? My numbers
are not degrees of belief. If could be complex, is that what you're saying?
No, my degree of belief will remain just as real and mod squared as it is in ordinary quantum mechanics. The numbers I put onto states will, just like yours, be complex. That's what I want to do. Now, I don't know why that is inevitable, but I know why it's not real. We know that this calculus does not work for quantum mechanics. But it is the only calculus which works for real values. This underlying structure in quantum mechanics.
So what would be the relation of these complex numbers to your...
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not doing quantum mechanics.
So can you repeat what was the assumption? I mean, weren't you dealing with degrees of belief, or were you, what were these numbers meant to represent in the classical situation?
So you had some functional equations, and the assumption is that the functions are real valued.
Yes.
And under the assumption that they're real valued, their solutions are. So. Yes.
But that doesn't, I mean, they're just numbers. Why should there be?
It is. And
if you relax that assumption, then you don't necessarily get the same solutions to the function.
I believe it is the case that the solution to the functional equations is of that same form, even if I allow complex algebra. The derivations just go through ordinary differentiation arguments and so on. I think those will follow through, but I do not know that.
But there's a very strong assumption, I think, behind this whole thing, which is that the number you assign to A or B should only be a assuming that A and B are exclusive, should only be a function of the number you assign to A and the number you assign to B.
If they're exclusive.
Someone could argue that, I wouldn't necessarily be convinced, but someone could argue that for degrees of belief, but if these numbers are just, you know, just mathematical numbers that don't correlate with any particular physical thing or mental thing, then I don't see where that assumption can be, the assumption seems to break down. Right? In other words, and then you won't get any of this conclusion.
Well, this Bayesian analysis does have some degree of success.
But there they think of them as degrees of belief. So I'm just saying, if you relax it, I don't see why.
Well, if the calculus will change.
There'll be a huge range of, well, okay. But I just
provide me
very skeptical that you'll get some inevitability.
Plenty of people have plenty of degrees of skepticism about that. I don't like it. Really? In fact, I rather like it because it reduces the competition.
I'm going to ask a question, but I'm going to need the help of the audience on this. So, because there was a talk here a few weeks ago where somebody was talking about this logic where if you know something, then something, but what happens if you don't know something? Do you remember that talk? And at the end, he was going to say something about Bayesian, and there's a fancy philosophical term for that. And I just wanted to, I'm being very vague. You're going to have to infer a lot from this question, right? But the idea is that, and this is, I remember, because this is sort of, he was trying to sort of bring what you can from philosophy into quantum mechanics. Do you remember that talk? It was here about 2 months ago. And it was the idea was, you know, there was this logical if A then B, but what happens if not A and if B, and he was taking all of these things. So I'm just, and then my colleague here asked him at the end, well, because in the abstract there was a statement about Bayesian, and he asked him about it, and he says, actually, I don't know the answer. So I know I'm being very vague, but does anybody remember that talk? I know a number of you were there for that. Okay. Sorry, I was hoping we could get a discussion on this because it's just this idea again of, I understand about inference, right? It's basically on what you observe and then what can you conclude, right? But people were, maybe he was abnormally obsessed with this, but it's related to quantum experiments, right? Which, what can you conclude if this doesn't happen, right? Okay, that's okay. I just thought maybe somebody could help me out there.
Well, I can't.
No, of course not. You're totally removed. Does anybody remember? That gentleman there, you were at this talk. You were at that talk.
Well, I sort of remember the talk, but I don't remember it in enough detail.
Yeah, okay. There was a fancy term that he used for this type of analysis and this connection. Counterfactuality. That's it. Thank you very much. Does that ring a bell? Have you seen that at all anywhere?
Okay. Well, I tend to run a mile faced with philosophers.
Good. Okay, that's fine. That's. I would agree with you. I just wanted to ask you if you saw that. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what. Well, I know. Okay. There are plenty of these things to come up in questions too. You read the words, and it just feels like something out of Zen. There may or may not be a meaning there. If there is, I can't find it.
Any other questions? Well, John's going to be here for a week, and he's sitting on the second floor in office
straight opposite Karen. I think it's called 205 or 206.
So if anyone would like to talk to him about that?
Yes, sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Except tomorrow morning when you
Except tomorrow morning.